Now, time for us to catch up on stories that have been making headlines around the world on this week's World Report with Justin McCarthy.
Good morning. On today's programme, Turkey's U-turn on Sweden's bid to join NATO and the deaths of hundreds of migrants attempting to reach the Canary Islands. But first we go to Australia, which will host the Women's Soccer World Cup beginning next week, with Ireland taking on the hosts on the opening day. And as Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, Australians love a grand sporting spectacle, and the scene is set for an absorbing month of elite football down under.
A friend who recently moved from London to Sydney said she was amazed by the amount of sport Aussie kids do at school. There is plenty to choose from, including Australian rules football, the rugby codes, cricket, tennis, golf, swimming and netball. But the most popular sport is football. Participation rates are high for girls, boys, men and women. While the build-up here to the Women's World Cup has been rather muted, there are unmistakable signs that the event will be embraced. More than a million tickets have already been sold for matches in Australia and New Zealand, surpassing the previous tournament in France in 2019. Demand for Australia's opening fixture against Ireland was so great that organisers had to move the match to the home of the Sydney Olympics. Stadium Australia is the World Cup's largest venue and has capacity for more than 83,000 fans. Most will be in the green and gold of the home side, but those in emerald will be hoping to upset the party. A few hours earlier, co-hosts New Zealand will officially kick off the competition against Norway in Auckland. Both Australia and New Zealand like to give their national sides names. New Zealand has the All Blacks, the Tall Blacks and the Black Sticks for their rugby union, basketball and hockey teams. Its women's soccer players are the Football Ferns. Australia's rugby league internationals are the Kangaroos, while its women's and men's football teams are the Matildas and Socceroos. The men bowed out of last year's World Cup in Qatar to the eventual champions Argentina. The Socceroos reignited Australia's passion for the game with an unexpected run into the round of 16. But it's the Matildas, which are arguably Australia's most popular sporting team. Sam Kerr, a striker for Chelsea in the Women's Super League, is the nation's most famous player, male or female. 32 nations will take part in the World Cup. In 1991, when it was first held, there were just a dozen teams. The United States are the defending champions and are hoping to become the first team to win the trophy three times in a row. With matches as far apart as Perth in Western Australia to the New Zealand capital Wellington, this tournament will be like no other in terms of distances. Ireland will travel 8,000 kilometres in the group stage alone. Controversies about alleged misconduct, money and equal pay for female players are likely to linger. But there is a feeling that New Zealand and Australia are hosting the tournament at a pivotal time for women's football. Its profile has never been higher and arguably the standards never better. A key factor is Australia's ability to throw a good sporting party. It has hosted spectacular events before and hopes to do so again. In 2026, the Commonwealth Games come to the state of Victoria before the 2032 Olympics are held in Brisbane. For once, Antipodean fans can watch the world's best football players on home soil. Usually, supporters have to endure very early mornings or late nights to watch games from Europe and North America on TV. For Australia and New Zealand, this will be a prime-time World Cup. Both countries love sports, and Australia in particular will believe they have a good chance of winning. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Next we go to Turkey. For more than a year, that country has been blocking Sweden's bid to join NATO, an unpopular position internationally. So pundits were expecting a small showdown when the leaders of the alliance gathered in Vilnius, Lithuania, for their annual summit last week. Instead, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan changed his mind quite quickly, and there was a quid pro quo, as Jasper Mortimer reports from Ankara.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan flew to the NATO summit last week with political goals and a card up his sleeve. The goals were to get Sweden to crack down harder on the Kurdish militants and Gulenists on its territory, and to get the United States to stop stalling on Turkey's request to buy 40 F-16 fighter bombers. The card up Erdogan's sleeve had to do with the rule that all members of NATO have to approve a new member, meaning that Turkey had a veto on Sweden's bid to join the alliance. Erdogan likes to be the maverick, casting himself as independent of the Western camp to which Turkey belongs by unbreakable economic and military ties. Westerners see him as unreliable, but his voters appreciate his defiance of Washington and Brussels. When Sweden and Finland applied to join NATO last year, most NATO states welcomed their application. But Erdogan objected. He accused Stockholm and Helsinki of harboring anti-Turkish militants, terrorists, as he called them. After the two Nordic countries had toughened their laws against extremists and lifted their arms embargoes on Turkey, Ankara lifted its veto against Finland. Finland joined NATO in April. But Turkey held out against Sweden, saying it had taken steps in the right direction, but it hadn't gone far enough. That was the position when, on Monday afternoon, Erdogan prepared to board the plane for the summit in Lithuania. He surprised journalists by linking his obstruction of Sweden to the European Union's obstruction of Turkey. "Come and open the way for Turkey at the European Union," he said, "and then we will open the way for Sweden." It was a breathtaking move. For months, Turkey had been arguing it was blocking Sweden on a point of principle, namely that Stockholm tolerates militants. But now Erdogan had swept principles aside. The prominent Turkish diplomatic journalist Barçın Yenenç commented, "Erdogan is a transactional leader." Yenenç was right. Erdogan was actually signaling flexibility. If accession to the EU was part of the equation, anything else could be. Erdogan landed in Vilnius and went straight into a meeting with Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Afterwards, Stoltenberg announced that Erdogan would ask Parliament to ratify Sweden's membership. Journalists had expected Erdogan to hold his Swedish card until the end of the two-day summit, throwing it on the table in the final negotiations. Instead, he had played the card before the summit had even begun. He knew he would be accused of conceding too much, so he avoided speaking to the press. His concession meant that when the summit began the next morning, the 31 member states could concentrate on a more important issue: how to help Ukraine against Russia. During the summit, Erdogan held bilateral meetings with EU Council President Charles Michel and US President Joe Biden. Michel promised the EU would re-energize its relations with Turkey, but he said nothing about opening the way for Turkey to join the bloc. That depends on Erdogan's improving human rights and weakening his grip on the judiciary and the press. Biden said Erdogan's approval of Sweden's membership showed courage, leadership, and diplomacy. Words of praise we don't often hear from the White House. And an anonymous US official told Agence France-Presse that Biden would actively engage with the Congress to get it to approve the sale of the fighter bombers. Wrapping up the summit, Secretary General Stoltenberg said NATO would appoint a special coordinator for counter-terrorism. And Erdogan told journalists that his efforts had had a significant impact on the decision. So, at the end of the day, Erdogan did not get Sweden to extradite more militants. He did not get the EU to restart accession negotiations. But he did make progress on acquiring the US fighter bombers, which was arguably his most important goal. This is Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Ankara.
Finally, we go to the Canary Islands, popular this time of year as a tourist destination, with thousands of people travelling there in search of sun and relaxation. But there are others who travel to the Canaries seeking sanctuary, safety and security. Migrants who undertake a deathly crossing to try to reach the islands in the hope of a better life. reports have emerged of hundreds of people dying on their desperate mission to reach the Canaries, darkly contrasting with the carefree image of the islands as portrayed to tourists, as Cliona O'Flynn reports.
As I record this piece for World Report, there are unofficially at least 300 people missing at sea, passengers in three small boats that set off from the coast of West Africa to try and reach the Canary Islands in the last 2 weeks. Three small boats, one we believe with over 200 people packed on board, hollowed out wooden boats, probably with no motors, no GPS, and unlikely to have any expert sailors on board. Three small boats that join a flotilla of small cayucos, as they are called here, kayaks, lost at sea, attempting what is widely accepted as one of the most dangerous ocean crossings in the world. And in recent months, we are seeing reports of three or four boats arriving to any one of our Canary Islands weekly, numbers beginning to rise again after a drop last year, with two-thirds of migrants entering Spain now doing so via the Canary Islands. Sometimes a sideshow too for the tourists on the beaches as they watch the rescue services bring people to ambulances or migrant centres off the rickety wooden vessels they have brought to shore. There are also at least 36 confirmed deaths from another boat that was located by the Spanish emergency services, but not before something of a standoff, as it appears neither Spanish nor Moroccan authorities wanted to take responsibility, and the boat was left for up to 10 hours in the open seas before a rescue attempt was made. This week, Maria Farnes Martinez, the public prosecutor for the Canary Islands, confirmed that she was accepting and proceeding with a complaint made by the NGO Caminando Fronteras that on June 21st the boat was left in limbo with 36 dead or missing and would be considering the failure of the Spanish rescue services to provide assistance for 10 hours a crime. Many of these deaths took place as the world was also watching TV, glued to the 24-hour news cycle as five individuals who had dived down to visit the wreck of the Titanic were being sought, and a still unknown number of migrants drowned in a boat off the Greek coast. Here in the Canary Islands, we're used to the arrival of boat people, with recent decades seeing a general rise in numbers making this perilous journey. These individuals, many whose names will not be on the front pages of any national newspapers, leave friends and families behind in search of an economically better existence. Some may have also travelled from danger zones, their lives at risk, and hope to seek refugee status when they arrive. As the crow flies, the shortest sea journey between the West African coast and Lanzarote, the most eastern of the Canary Islands, is only about 70 miles and nearer points to Morocco exist, though recently the political atmosphere between Spain and Morocco could be improved. It probably seems like a relatively easy trip. More and more too, we are learning that climate change-induced drought in Africa is causing increasing levels of poverty in agricultural areas, and combine that with the effect industrial fishing has had on local populations' reliance on that trade along the coast. It's not too surprising that families will fund one or two of their younger members to head off in search of a better, more financially stable existence. There are differing statistics as to how many have died trying to make the journey. Last year, it was over 500. In 2021, official at-sea death total was about 400, but the Walking Borders charity says it was over 1,000. Sukaina Ndiaye, leader of a migrant support group here in Tenerife, said, "There is panic among people in Africa after the pandemic, the war in Ukraine and inflation because they are so dependent on food from outside." There are those who make it here. Thousands arrive every year. There were over 22,000 arrivals in 2021, nearly 16,000 last year, and about 8,000 to date this year. Many are sent back, including two who travelled across from Togo, clinging to the rudder of a ship. They were sent back on Thursday, just 2 days after they arrived in the Canaries. In general, migrants who arrive by boat are detained for up to 72 hours while their paperwork is processed, and many are then sent to refugee camps to await repatriation or to hear if an application for refugee status is approved. The latter does not happen in very many cases. Last month, and this with better weather conditions, there's been something of a surge. Boats are arriving a few a week at the moment. A worker in a migrant centre reported arrivals topping 1,000 in recent days. It's easy to report numbers, but the truth is, as journalists, readers, watchers, listeners, we never get to hear the names of those who don't make it. Those on the boat with 200 passengers still missing were apparently nearly all from the same village and left from a fishing port, Cofontaine, on June 27th. A spokesperson for a charity told the Spanish authorities, "One father is ringing us every day. He has three children on board." For World Report, this is Cliann O'Flynn in Tenerife.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.